Okay, everybody, this is Wayne Ranney, and it's November the 5th, 2022. We're here at mine and Helen Ranney's home at 628 North Apollo Way in Flagstaff, and we are with Mike Buchheit once again. And the last time we were with Mike was down in Phoenix on September the 2nd, and we're just covering a few other things from Mike's famous employment there at Grand Canyon National Park. Mike, you are, to me, a Grand Canyon all-star, and that's why I want to do this oral history with you. And thank you for coming up to Flagstaff. Tonight you'll be at the Grand Canyon Youth event telling another story about a river trip with Grand Canyon Youth back in 2011. But speaking about the river, you were involved with starting up the motorized version of educational field trips, excuse me, on the river with the Grand Canyon Association, now the Grand Canyon Conservancy. And that was a big deal to go into the dark side and do the motor trips. Can you talk a little bit about the process of that?
Sure. It's great to be here and to be considered an all-star by my all-star is high praise. Thank you, Wayne. So, In terms of the Field Institute, we really cut our teeth as a backpacking enterprise. And that was in the spirit of our genesis, which was at the request of the Park Service to start a program for the Grand Canyon Natural History Association, now going way back, to help the Park Service meet some of the interpretive and educational needs of the park. And these weren't clear lines, but basically we did things the rangers would love to do, taking people out for multi-day trips, deep dive educational experiences. But in terms of liability, in some cases expertise and budgets, it was just better off in our shop. So we did a lot of backpacking in the early days of commercial guiding, really. Yeah. So this was in the early 90s, right through present day, I'm told. So so we would have subject matter experts that were trailworthy, if not ambulatory, taking 6, 7, 8, 9, up to 10 clients out on everything from beginning backpacks to some real orienteering-type hardcore stuff. So we really carved out a very nice niche for ourselves with the blessing of the Park Service, doing that very thing, especially in the spring and the fall during the prime backpacking.
And I can't remember if we talked about this before, but the group of instructors that you were able to garner to that program really made it top-notch.
They were the program at the end of the day. I was just refilling gauze and whatnot.
I want to disagree with you there, because it did need to have consistent and fun leadership, and you hit it on both accounts. I do want to say that really you and Jack being there made us want to come back and work for the Field Institute.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't great pay, but it was fair pay. And we got to play in the Grand Canyon. I mean, that's...
Well, amen to that. So, and Jack would be Jack Pennington, my longtime partner in crime and assistant director, I think was his last title. The program, the centerpiece of the program was having subject matter experts in the hard sciences, artists, you know, photographers, painters, writers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to get that kind of talent in front of clients who oftentimes just signed up because they tried 100 times to get a rim-to-rim permit and never were lucky. So then at the end of a six-day rim-to-rim backpack, they get back to the shop and they're like, I can't believe I had Wayne Ranney's undivided attention for 6 days.
I just wanted a free permit to go down there. I couldn't get a permit.
And a transportation to the North Rim. Go figure. So they'd tell two friends and they'd tell two friends. So Yeah, that was the real joy.
And I think at first you did have an ore-powered river trip that was part of the program. It wasn't when the program got started, but somewhere along the line, Krista came to you, Krista Sadler.
So two of our charter instructors, thank you, were Krista Sadler and Andre Potoshnik, who both were longtime river runners by that point. And they suggested we do an interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary ore-powered river trip as a charter. And I think our first one was in 1996. So the program was 3 or 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So we chartered with Canyon Explorations / Expeditions. And at that point, our following was such that, in river trips being a new offering, we were lucky to sell half a trip. So we would sell an upper or a lower. And then CanX would sell the reverse of that to the general public.
Oh, you would do a half a trip.
We would do a half a trip. And then the crew would stay on,
mm-hmm.
But the clients would hike out the Bright Angel, and then the quote-unquote fresh meat would hike in the Bright Angel and take their spots. So it played out like that for several years. At some point, we started to work with Tour West. It was kind of off and on because they were giving us wider latitude in putting together a crew that Krista, who was our trip leader, was vetting for their natural history presentations and cultural history presentations as well. So pretty soon, we were booking that thing solid. And we had a very extensive waiting list, and it was a fabulous addition to our portfolio. It was sort of one-stop shopping for geology, paleontology, hydrology, journaling, on and on and on.
I remember when the program was so successful, you would have waiting lists for that trip that stretched out 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Ahead of the year that they would call and
say, that was a little tricky because, and this is a look behind the curtain, but we finally had to start taking some non-refundable deposits even several years out because, you know, if a party of six, at the end of the day, it was a charter.
Yeah.
So if a party of six canceled, not at the 11th hour, but at the 10th hour, we'd have to fill those spots on short notice or beg forgiveness from Lori Lee Stavely. Thank you, Lori. And that didn't happen too often. But back to the, I want to tip my hat to the Park Service again. So one of the, let's just say it, a competitive advantage we had, especially when the commercial guiding really took off, and I'd like to think we had a lot to do with that. Part of our arrangement with the Park Service to help them fill in their educational gaps was that we had dibs on backcountry permits for advertised classes. That's the way we could tell the public that and pin one of our globetrotting experts down. Wayne Ranney is going to lead a 6-day backpack in November. Come and get it, you know. So now we're back onto backpacking. Be able to advertise a class with an instructor and start taking money from people. So most of the commercial guiding companies didn't have that luxury. So it was a little bit of a scramble for them oftentimes to get clients and talent at the last minute once they knew they had a verifiable client list. The river trips were going well. We went to two a year on some occasions when we had, these were again ore power trips. So I can't remember the first date that we did a motor trip, but Wayne and I think put heads together and said, let's give it a shot.
The way I remember it is you had those long waiting lists for the ore trip. I was already doing some motor trips, geology themed. with Azra and Colorado River and Trail Expeditions. And I think when you were just expressing a little frustration with the waiting list for the ore trip, I may have mentioned to you, you know, you could also try a motor trip. They're shorter in length.
That rings a bell.
They're just as educational. We could try that. And I think within a year or two, we started to move forward.
We got in the swing of it, yeah. So we, every motor trip that was chartered during my tenure was with Azra. So,
yeah.
And with great results.
I think they still use them.
And we didn't have the ability, not to get too wonky on this, but all the gray hair on my chin that you guys can't see right now was the fact that we were afforded one instructor, so Wayne got to wear many hats mm-hmm. on a trip like that. We couldn't load it up with other disciplines like we were doing on the ore power trips.
Right.
But as it turned out, Wayne could talk about archaeology and river history and then inevitably the motor captain and the helper that Azra would throw into the mix would more often than not be selected with their ability to help with the education.
And I think we did both one boat trips with 12 passengers and a few times two boat trips with 24 passengers. So we had waiting lists for those too.
Yep.
And I will say this, that it was a pleasure working for Azra, but in my view, I think that some of their guides had a hard time figuring out what to do with somebody who the guides might consider to be a passenger, but was taking up all of the stage space from them. And so I decided to bow out from that trip. And I think since that time, Melissa Giovanni has been running that trip. And the Field Institute is still doing that. So
running that trip, yeah.
It's really good that the Conservancy is still doing that trip. And that brings to mind also something that I think you and Jack initiated through the Field Institute, and that's the guide training seminar.
Yeah, thank you for that. And backing up a little bit, Azra is a common acronym here in Flagstaff, but that's Arizona Raft Adventures,
that's
and I
right.
would highly recommend them for anybody looking
they run
for
quality trips.
For an outfitter. So yeah, the guides training seminar. So one of the things that we did on the South Rim through the Field Institute was that we would host annually, a weekend devoted to guide craft, to best practices. It was open to everyone, but it was really designed for backcountry guides and companies. And park rangers, mule wranglers, anybody who's in front of the public and talking about the canyon.
And it sort of was like based on the model of the guide training seminar that the river guides have. Is that correct?
It turned out that way, but the genesis of it, this might be, you may not know this, but
okay.
You do. Okay. So one of the other... So I mentioned earlier that the Field Institute was in many ways conducting programs on behalf of the Park Service, that, mm-hmm. that if they could, they would be leading backpacks and river trips. Well, another piece of that was that I would have to have, or the director of the Field Institute, whoever that might be, it was me for most of my run, to submit my plans to the chief of interpretation for a sign-off. And that would be where we're going, how many people, who's going to lead it, what's our impact on the permitting apparatus, what park-wide interpretive themes are we going to share with people, you know, some real granular detail about our trips. And then they could circulate that to all the divisions within the Park Service that had a dog in the fight. You know, the backcountry office, the Visitor and Resource Protection, the Science Center, they'd all have a chance to weigh in on the plans that we were formulating. And then we would ultimately get a go forth and educate, you know, assigned copy of the plan for the forthcoming year.
I'm just curious, did that end up becoming a formality when it became obvious that the Field Institute was not just a gang of rogues wanting?
Well, yes and no. So it was that was a requirement from the get-go.
Right.
When we started in 1993.
And it makes sense.
Yeah. So somewhat based on the personal relationship I had with Ellis Richards, who was the chief of interpretation at the time. So I had two or three chief of interpretations over my tenure. Some took it more serious than others.
Okay.
So we had a request to do a on-demand or a private experience out in Western Grand Canyon. And I sent him a high-level description of what we were going to do. And my recollection is that he did say okay.
Is this like a custom trip?
Custom trip, yeah. Which we did infrequently, but sometimes our diehard following would want to go somewhere with someone.
Yeah.
And we would find a path to yes. So we embarked on this trip. And when they got back, there were some people, Park Service rangers, that took umbrage with the places that we went and the things that we talked about.
Oh, okay.
So that became an issue, and it was kind of a tense meeting, as I recall. Frankly, since this is for the record, the Field Institute as a program was on the line, unbeknownst to me, because it was seen as a betrayal of that process.
Crossing a line.
Yeah. So my solution was, okay, this program is growing. We're out there in front of the public. In many ways, under the auspices of the Park Service, and wouldn't it be great if our instructors would come together once a year, just before the season kicked in March, and you could bring whoever you wanted, National Park Service, in front of our team and bring them up to speed on rules and regs, the latest and greatest, things we could share with our clients, what the Park Service's goals are and how they're trying to accomplish that. And let's work together to make that happen.
Another instance where you saved the Field Institute.
Well, yes, I guess. We, not I. So it sounded like such a good idea that I said, why would we limit this to just the Field Institute instructors? Let's open it up to the whole guiding industry.
Fantastic.
Which is what we did, and it was an instant hit. And the Park Service got an opportunity to roll out new updates and initiatives to the whole guiding community, where no one could say, we never heard about that.
Yeah.
Or what do you mean a backcountry management plan is getting delayed another year or another 10 years? Inside joke. Sorry, Linda Jalbert. And we talked about it at the guides training seminar. So we ran that every year for 15 or 16 years.
It was brilliant. I remember the first ones were there in the community building, and eventually it got to be so popular, we outgrew that and had to move to the Shrine of the Ages. And it was so wonderful to work with other guides who honestly thought of the Grand Canyon Field Institute guides as a bunch of hoity-toity snobs who thought they were the best people out there, but we got to rub shoulders with the Four Season guides and the Pygmy guides and the, Wilderness? trek guides, and it was wonderful. Wildland trekking, that's
all. Wildland trekking, yep. And it was, and I think we helped incubate a lot of the more successful commercial guiding companies through the process, because they would get to meet the rangers and vice versa. So we always had a social evening, and it was a great networking opportunity. And I'd come away from it with a stack of resumes. And so it was a great recruiting tool for us. But I think another thing it helped us do was it helped the Field Institute reassert itself as a arm-in-arm partner of the Park Service, you know, not just for education, but the conservancy in general, for fundraising or philanthropy and membership and on and on and on. So, you know, retail or retail operation. And the thing that I never looked forward to, I guess we have lots of room here, was the backcountry office report, usually by Steve Sullivan or Mark Warner, because that preferential treatment we had with backcountry permits was irksome to a lot of the commercial guiding companies.
Oh, I remember that.
That had, you know, they had to jockey with, you know.
They wanted the same deal the Field Institute.
They wanted the same deal. Yeah, they saw it as preferential treatment, or they saw it as a leg up.
And in case the listeners don't know, is that much prior to a season, you would put in certain dates for specific heights, hikes, and the Park Service would sign off. So well before those permits became available to everybody else, the Field Institute would take not a whole lot of dates.
And I'll get to that, yeah.
Not a whole lot of dates, but they still created some tension with some of the outfitters.
That had people standing in line in the snow waiting for the backcountry office to open in the morning to try to get a last-minute permit. But those companies that we had warmer relations with, the word got out basically that before they put their anticipated dates together for the forthcoming year, they could call myself or Jack Pennington and just say, you know, we know you get the group site at Indian Garden whenever you're scheduled for it. What are your dates next year? Yeah. And we'll just work around that. So there was a gentlemanly workaround that I think everybody got what they needed. But they would come in and talk about, this would be Steve Sullivan or Mark Warner, or one of their designees. I think Steve Bridgehouse did it a couple of years. And they would come in and they would talk about the total number of permits that were used by the commercial guiding industry. And then they would break out how many the Field Institute got in any given year. This would be available nights in the backcountry, in the corridor, the popular rim-to-rim route. And it was insubstantial. It was probably, you know, 3% of the total.
I'd be surprised if it was even that much.
Yeah. And the daggers would go back in the sheaths at that point, because people would just be itching to, some people would be itching to yet again raise the Field Institute's inside track.
Well, I wasn't privy to those conversations you were having with the other private outfitters, but just in my own mind, I could step back from it and look. You probably offered in a whole year 2 hermit to Indian Garden hikes.
Yeah.
1 Tanner hike. Possibly 5 rim to rim hikes, if it were that many. It may not have been, but it wasn't that many.
Well, and then we had an agreement with the Park Service where during the peak hiking months, we wouldn't take any more than X number of large group sites.
Yeah.
So we intentionally fanned out to do more, you know, Bass Boucher loops or New Hants to Grandview and and stuff off the North Rim. And that created new opportunities for us as a program to teach orienteering skills, wilderness studies classes with Ken Walters and others. So it was an organic evolution of both the breadth of our program, the things that we offered, where we were going and when. And but I thought it was fairly collegial.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like I say, there at the end of all of those, I mean, it was wonderful. It was something you look forward to. I know that I would save time on my calendar to be there just to visit with fellow guides, the camaraderie. And from my point of view, it really did establish really good relations between private outfitters and the Field Institute, which was really an arm of the Park Service.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't feel it was a bad thing that you may have got a little bit of preferential situation. I can understand why they felt that way, but...
And we paid for our permits like everybody else, but it was just a...
Yeah.
Like I said, an inside track. Two more things I'd add, and then we can... one is that it wasn't just rangers talking to people. It was experts like Wayne and people from NAU, Brian Brown, talking about birds. Jack Pennington took over the orchestration of the agenda about halfway through the run. And he took pride in, and my hat's off to him, for having 80% new content every year. So he was really cycling through some great talent. Leave No Trace experts. We would do a tour of the Hella Base. For me personally, that was golden. So that would be all of us standing around an airship with the search and rescue team saying, okay, when we come in, here's how you prepare a landing area. You know, these are the things we want to know, and then we want to get the hell out of there. And so the first time somebody saw an airship where they could reach out and touch it during a crisis on a beach somewhere, wasn't, you know, right there when the adrenaline's pumping and you might be making mistakes. So those were the opportunities we created that I'm sure are paying dividends to this very day and beyond this.
Absolutely.
And one more thing.
Yeah.
Part of the hypersensitivity about the permit allotment, and this harkens back to the river GTS, was there are a number of individuals who've been in the thick of the fight about permit, private versus commercial permit allotments on the river that were very keen on, if not passionate about, making sure that doesn't happen with backpacking permits.
Mm-hmm.
And we find ourselves back into that. That situation. So that's again where that annual presentation by the Backcountry Permit Office would put people at ease or on alert. You know, I can't say how everyone reacted to those conversations, but I think that was a value.
Well, it was a wonderful thing, and I can only hope that the Conservancy will bring it back at some point. Because it was really, besides learning all of the nuts and bolts about the Grand Canyon's hydrology or birds or reptiles, it was just a way for Grand Canyon lovers to get together. And those meals that were served on the final night, I mean, that was such a warm and embracing thing. So,
and that was typically Delaware North would open up the atrium at the Yavapai Cafeteria. And it would be just cordoned off for a bunch of Teva-wearing, fleece-clad, crusty guides fresh off the trail. And we'd empty those hors d'oeuvre trays immediately and some adult beverages. And
nothing like free food to get the guides
coming
in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, this GTS and guide training seminar speaks to the multi-day backpacks, which, as you said correctly, you know, that's really what the Field Institute was about. But another thing that you did during your tenure there was really grow the Day Tour program, and that had a rough start, as I remember. I mean, just trying to get people to sign on for a six-hour tour with a guide on the rim of the canyon. But talk a little bit about how you grew that part of the program.
Sure. So, so we had a very rigid schedule in the early days, so really through the 90s, where we had, you know, 25 backpacking classes. And if you were not a backpacker or didn't want to learn how to be on our beginning backpacker classes, you didn't have much to choose from. We'd have multi-day geology programs on the rim, light hiking into the canyon. We'd have multi-day plein air painting classes, et cetera, et cetera. But we more and more, we would have people call and say, hey, I'm bringing my extended family. I'm bringing my, we have a conference in Flagstaff of geophysicists, and we want to do a field trip to the canyon. And can you hook us up with an expert? And we would say, we had a reflexive yes. And we would pre-approve with the Park Service a suite of places we could take people on foot. And they would be okay with that. And then that would be portable for subsequent groups that would call. So we had sort of a menu of offerings. And the beauty of that was, and some of the commercial guiding companies figured this out earlier than we did, that you could really keep your people, your guides, busy year round if you positioned yourself and marketed yourself as a company that could provide those opportunities. So we, by the end of my time there, we were doing 150. I mean, it wasn't daily. We tried that a couple of times, but it was a little tricky.
That's what I remember. There was some kind of a advert with people staying at a Zantara hotel.
Well, that was a learning and lodging package.
And that preceded this other thing that we're talking about?
They were on parallel tracks.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And more often than not, if people signed up for a learning and lodging, we didn't hit our base number. They have the hotel room already. We just translate that into a private day tour and find, you know, agree on a number. So that kept a lot of people very busy. Logistically, it was very challenging because most of our talent resides in Flagstaff or Prescott and Sedona, Las Vegas. So it's some commute time. So you'd have to, if you activated somebody, you need to follow through because they might be turning down, if you're giving them 3 or 4 gigs in a week, they might be turning down a Mongolian, you know, falcon survey or something. And, you know, these are people with lives and jobs and rent and mortgages. And so that was the behind the scenes stuff.
Well, at least Slim Woodruff lived on the south
rim. Oh, yeah. Well, she was across the parking lot from me. I couldn't knock on the pipes and get her, but I could yell across the parking lot and activate. You know, and it would get tricky. You know, and we knew people's strengths. We could, you know, we were in the yes business. So if somebody called and said, okay, we've got people that English is not their first language. If you have a Flemish speaking falconer or an Arabic boatman, or our answer would be absolutely. And we'd hang up and I'd be like, Jack, who do we know who speaks Swahili?
Well, Slim was going to go hiking in the canyon whether you called or not. And if you called, she'd get paid for it.
This is Marjorie Woodruff, one of our go-to. So she had a lot of variety in her diet, as did everybody. So we had probably a core group of 20 or 25 contract instructors that we could throw at just about anything.
And this program got to be good enough that some big names would be coming to the park for a single day. And
yeah,
I remember one time I did Ari Fleischer. who was the press secretary for
George
W. Bush. And it seems like I had a couple of other people that I can't recall, but you took out a couple of big names, and these were just day trips, four-hour trips to the rim.
Well, one of my, and I was thinking about this on my drive up today, is like one of the, in recruiting contract instructors, I don't have the degrees and the background to be vetting some of the people that came through my door with an appointment or otherwise. And some of the real experts in the hard sciences and so forth. But I was trying, on the drive up here today, I was thinking, what was really like in the back of my mind a baseline expectation for anybody, whether they were a PhD or just a somebody who earned their stripes rowing bags, that had some natural history studies in, you know, Kalamazoo or whatever. It, for me personally, it was that they would be as enthusiastic and as forthcoming, whether it was a bellman or a billionaire, you know, to bring it, to bring their A game for every encounter.
Yeah.
And sometimes it didn't work right away, and you'd have to do a little training. You know, that's why we took post-course surveys where we could kind of spot any issues like that. And they were few and far between. It was just all about improving our game, and everybody was on board.
Well, you also had your assistants that would go on the backpacks, and that was something that had to be developed, because when I started, it was just one guide with as many as 10 clients. And it probably was people like Stuart Acheson and myself who refused to go to Woofer class that you realized, oh my God, we're sending out Wayne Ranney and we're sending out Stuart Acheson, and all they have is advanced first aid or something like that. And then you realized, well, let's send out a second person.
Well,
that assistant could eventually see how the program ran and then could work their way up to being.
But I knew that like if they had a femoral artery bleed, you could turn that into a talk about lava flows or something. I mean, you would.
Well, my thing was,
the last thing they would hear about.
Nobody was allowed to get injured on my trip. That was just the rule. You say, oh.
So all joking aside, safety was number one. But the Park Service did eventually, in the commercial guiding industry, to be leading people into the canyon, day hike or otherwise, you had to have a wilderness first responder, a.k.a. woofer.
Yeah.
So for that reason and others, we wanted to have two people on every overnight, certainly, in the canyon. Just because if the group got strung out, you know, it was an undue burden on the instructors. It was one more thing to worry about. Like if you're talking to the people in the front about everything, the people in the back feel like they got cheated.
Well, it almost seems now like ridiculous that you'd only have one person, because if you had a problem and somebody needed to eject at Cedar Ridge or at the Mile and a Half House, you're there. What are you going to do? You're going to send them up by themselves or take the rest down?
Yeah. I mean, you know. And see the other gray hairs over here? Because and then in the early days, we didn't have sat phones. Yeah. We had air transceivers, which were slightly better than having two styrofoam cups and a thread from you to the Papillon helicopter overhead. It's a lot. Do we all turn around? Do I run that person back out and then hook up with my group?
Yeah.
Or, God forbid, the instructor goes down.
Like I did.
And
once.
You got 10 people looking at each other that, you know, paid clients. Like, okay, shit, what do we do now?
Yeah.
So for all those reasons and more, it just made sense to have two.
Well, I do want to bring up very quickly that you would always have a stellar record. I should say the Field Institute had a stellar record for not having helicopter dragouts for many, many seasons.
Yeah.
I know it must have happened a couple of times at some certain seasons, but We'd have our annual meetings, which, by the way, are worth memorializing as well. Those annual meetings, sometimes here at this house, sometimes at Tom Meyer's house.
And that's an all-instructor, quasi-mandatory end of year and
discussion. Get together and talk about the season.
And if memory serves, since we're sitting in Casa Ranny right now, Helen and Wayne met in Tom Meyer's living room.
Yes, November of 2005.
The sparks were flying. I don't know what I was talking about, but you weren't listening.
Even Bonnie Berger, who happened to be at that meeting, was sitting over there and said, "I felt that buzz."
She could feel the heat. Anyway, two of my favorite people. So,
well, talk to me about the hands-on series at the Field Institute.
Okay, well, a slight detour. So I do get called occasionally to help programs that are starting or maturing, you know, what would be five things. This is just more an advisory,
what
not
kind
a
of program
consultant. This would be like Petrified Forest Field Institute.
Talking
with them next Monday, for example. And they've got a fledgling program up and running. And if they ask me about the keys to our success, I'll bring up the guides training seminar that I think that's something that every park should have.
Yeah.
Every national mall. Anyone who has outdoor education happening, there's no reason not to have that program for all the reasons we've kind of droned on about. But the second one, if you're a brand spanking new program, I would say don't waste any time helping your park partner, whether it's the Forest Service, the Park Service, the BLM, help them achieve their educational and resource management goals. If they close their eyes on the topic of a solution and your face comes up, you're well positioned to grow the program and move forward. So in that spirit, almost from the get-go at the Field Institute, we would offer collaborative programs with the Science Center. I'm not sure what they're called these days. Science and
resources.
They've got a fancier name.
Oh, now. I'm not aware.
But they're the Science Center. That's what my tramp stamp reads.
Okay.
So it would be calling Jan Balsam, who's been there forever, and saying, what are you going to survey next year? Oh, we're going out to Pasture Wash, or we're going out the Desert View area or Valhalla Plateau. Okay, well, can we advertise that as a Field Institute class with tuition, priced like any other class? We'll feed them. We'll absorb the cost of the food buy, and we'll get as many people as you want to get the work done. And she's like, absolutely. So park vehicles, park personnel doing the education at the end of the day, but out there leading the habitat restoration programs or looking for artifacts or walls or terraces. Or it's basically someplace they know is artifact rich that they want to get back to.
So basically they come up with the idea and you supply the bodies.
Yeah. And again, I'm going to tip my hat to Jack Pennington, who really ran with this. He did it while he was working for the Park Service. So he was a natural bridge between the two entities. And they were wildly popular. And we'd have the same people signing up year after year.
Oh, wow.
And not a few of those people became donors for... what do we do with the data now? Well, if we had somebody to enter all this stuff in the system, that'd be great. Well, how much would that cost at the government rate? Well, XXX. Okay, checks in the mail.
Oh, wow.
Everybody wins. So we help to further the understanding of Grand Canyon National Park. It's a revenue positive outing for us. It could easily turn into feed the donor pipeline. The Park Service gets their mission accomplished. It's a win-win win-win-win. So I think in the 23, 24 years I was there, I think we did at least one or two a year.
Wow.
So when you think of the man hours that mm-hmm. we helped generate, it's thousands.
What are some of the projects that they worked on with this hands-on series?
Let's see.
Pasture Wash?
Pasture Wash was a pretty typical...
Was that a restoration of the cabin?
No, that was bandied about, but we never, mm-hmm. that never went through. There were a few gallant efforts to do that over the years that I was around the table.
That's why I mentioned it. You hear it all the time.
I was around the table and it never happened. I think the conversation would usually stop when somebody said, well, we took a peek in the window and there's mouse dung that's waist deep. It's like, okay, what's the next agenda item here? But no, to answer your question, I think Pasture Wash was a typical destination. The Desert View area, Valhalla Plateau. We incorporated some of that on one of these multidisciplinary river trips where we would check out some things down there if we had a Park Service person along that could...
Was the rehabilitation of the Granite Rapid Beach? I know that Helen worked
We
on
stopped
that.
There and filled up the Olos, I think. Yeah, we would stop, yeah. So there were a few river level habitat restoration programs. At Soap Creek, there were some Olos, some an ancient technology where you have a ceramic vessel beneath the beach with holes in it, and if you pour water in that, it irrigates the terrace. One at Granite, I think at Whitmore, there was some work done at Whitmore Wash. So when the Field Institute trips would go through the canyon, we would inevitably stop at these places to educate, maybe to report back what we found, maybe fill up some of the Olos, and talk about how private philanthropy through the Grand Canyon Conservancy can help the Park Service get some cool things done that the government funding would not address. So, you know, it was never a shakedown or we weren't rattling the cup per se, but I know for a fact that people came away from those river trips.
Yeah.
And said, where do I sign?
Yeah.
So, and Helen was, in her capacity as a major gift officer, I forget her exact title for the Conservancy when I was there, but she was up to her ears in philanthropy. And
she wore a couple of hats when she worked there.
She did. And Wayne was our ace in the hole while we're at it. So if we had a high-profile group, a high-capacity group, you know, people from a big foundation or people that wanted to see how the park works, what the needs were. It was a very short list of people we would get in front of them, and Wayne and Helen were always in the top five, usually together.
Yeah, I remember some of those trips.
So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, just to finish up today, maybe you can talk a little bit about the Canyon Field School.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't know that much about it myself, but I know it's something that... you want to just get on the record here.
Yeah, the field school, and maybe the next time we record, I can add anything. So the branch division of environmental education, which was part of the division of interpretation at Grand Canyon National Park, for years they had a very robust program for visiting school groups. Led for a long time by Jacob Fillion until he retired. And they ultimately wanted to brand that. It was so popular that they named that the Canyon Field School. Not to be confused with the Grand Canyon Field Institute. So there was a fair bit of thought that went into the nomenclature. So... they started to do more programs that involved overnight visits with school groups. So they would be camped at Mather Campground, or they might get some discount rooms and sleep, you know, five to a room, boy, girl rooms. And there was no end to the interest in that. So along the way, we said, well, why don't we, if we had a residential educational learning center, think of the things we could do. And you see those around the country. It's a dying brand because the pandemic really knocked a lot of these programs to the curb. But they could be dormitories. They could be car camping. You know, there's all kind of, they come in lots of flavors. So what we settled on, well, let's raise the money for, buy the supplies and building materials for a platform tent base camp that could accommodate 40, 50
wow.
high school kids with a cooking tent, a first aid tent. You know, the Cadillac version would have transportation and branding and you name it. So with the help of Arizona Public Service and other many other donors, we raised the money to buy the camp. And we worked closely with the Park Service to identify a spot, which is, it's off of Rawell Road on about an acre and a half, a disturbed area. So it didn't have to go through too much compliance. I forget if it was Pete Berry or Martin Buglin or somebody had a, some kind of a...
This was like an old camp. Picnic area in the old days?
Of Grand yeah, Canyon it's Park. Had many iterations. Yeah. So we built it from the ground up. The Field Institute was, it was jointly administered. We had a blended workforce. The camp manager worked, reported directly to me. And it was, we got one full year in and then the pandemic hit.
Did you have the platform tents?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I didn't know this.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's probably why we are not having 100,000 kids a year out there, if you hadn't heard about it. But we got one full season in. I missed most of that because I was out on a medical emergency, personal issue. And then the pandemic hit and the Park Service said, eight kids to a platform tent and bunk beds, and I don't think so. So we suspended operations two summers in a row. And as far as I know, you know, the tents are stored in a warehouse now. The platforms are still out there.
Wow.
But it was an interesting place. I remember the first day we had the first school group coming, and I got a call from my counterpart in the Park Service, Todd Stoberl, who was the chief of interpretation at the time. And he said, I was out there on my way to the Waldron Trailhead over the weekend, and there were 12 cows, feral livestock, out there in the, and they wouldn't get out, right in the heart of this camp, including steers with, and I heard the same thing from Darren, who was out there with his Jeep Wrangler for another reason. And so my first challenge was, wow, we got a school group that's going to be here any minute now. And we got a bunch of animals. You can't just go out and shoot them. So,
although the thought did crush.
The thought did, truth be told. But we did, we called Visitor Resource Protection and they went out there with bullhorns and scared them off. But... You know, it's, yeah. So, I hope it's resurrected someday because it's a golden idea with vast potential.
Yeah.
But yeah, if maybe we can circle back to that.
Well, this has been great, Mike, and I don't know if you have any parting words on today's session, but. I enjoyed talking about all these things and also from our visit on September the 2nd. And we can continue this if more things come to mind. It's open-ended, so.
Oh, yeah. We'll get more for later. There's more where that came from.
So. Yeah.
So, yeah, if the talk tonight at the Grand Canyon Youth fundraiser. Doesn't scare me off from public speaking. I have Wayne's going to set me up, and I have 8 minutes. I feel like a bit of an interloper to be addressing a room full of 100-trip salty river veterans, but I think I can hold my own. So
yeah, everybody shows up in a good mood. So
yeah,
we'll let you get ready for that. Thanks, Mike.
Off to the showers. Thank you, Wayne.
Yep. Okay. Adios.
Take care, people.